Did you play any role in the formation of the strategies that Admiral Zumwalt is associated with, for example, Sea Lords or the Sea Float concept?
He had that well in hand, like I said, even before he got to Vietnam. He had his concept fairly well outlined and with many details in mind that others weren't even aware of. And by the time I got there, that strategy was well formulated. I'd love to be able to take credit for it because it was so good, I thought, but no, it was underway and functioning, and my mission was to see that it was carried out the direction that he wanted it done, because I certainly had no fault with it.
Did this continue to develop after you got there? For example, when something like Giant Slingshot was established and the command has time to observe it in operation, was how much fine tuning of it was
there? Sure, there was always fine tuning, and we got good feedback from the on-scene commanders also. They had suggestions to make. There were changing conditions, such as the monsoon season. You would have ample waters in the canals and the waterways, and if the rain stopped, you would find that suddenly you're running in a ditch and you were about 10 feet below the landline and you were a perfect sitting target. Sometimes you might be aground instead of moving in the boat. So everything took fine tuning, and the local commanders, as is pretty much Navy tradition, had an opportunity to make decisions on the spot. That's only what you can expect of them when they're out of communications or when they're somebody but them on scene to evaluate the situation. This differs significantly from Army doctrine, which is pretty rigid in many instances, and goes all the way back to the traditions of days under sail. When you left port, the commanding officer had his orders and a mission to carry out, and he was expected to use the flexibility that was inherent in being out of communications with your immediate superior. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we mucked that up with radio and such things as that over the years. But it still is a certain characteristic that the other services sometimes admire, but we're sometimes criticized for not having a solid doctrine. As you may remember, Blake Donovan's paper, I think, questioned, did the Navy have a doctrine in Vietnam? And the point was yes, and it was written as we went along.
Right, that was the sense I got, is that this is something that's constructed as you learn what works and what does not. How much, follow on from that, how much do you think the United States Navy learned from what the French had experienced in through their use of river assault squads, and boats, groups?
I can't really evaluate that because they were long gone by that time. I know there's been criticism that we didn't draw on our own experiences of the Civil War, and the Spanish-American War, where we had rivering gunboats and such, but I know the reading I've done of the Civil War, there were a lot of lessons to be learned of actions where the smaller craft did tremendous jobs of harassing the Confederates' rear, trying to defend Richmond from the waterways of the York River and James River. Remember going to the Riverine School in San Francisco. I stopped off there for one day of this week's course I was supposed to have with it. And it looked to me like we were drawing on the lessons that had been learned by those who had just completed tours there. And they would incidentally have unit commanders program to enter the U.S. to San Francisco so they could debrief the instructors on what's actually going on now in a given area, and they would translate that then into lessons to the students. But how much we learned from the French, I'm not that good a historian to say.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a sense at least when you were there, that this is what the French experienced, this is what they did wrong, maybe we better learn from that or find a better way.
I think so. that conclusion had already been reached, and the people on scene had gone through that sort of thinking. Whether it was they came to the right conclusions or not, I don't know, because I'm not familiar enough with what the French tactics were or even their forces. Mm-hmm. Well, that'd be a good question to ask him.
Okay. If the barrier strategy and the interdiction strategy was already in place, or pretty well in place before you got there, how about sea float? Was that a concept that developed while you were there?
Sea float was in its conceptual phase then, and Commander Dick Nicholson was in charge both of supervising the construction and outfitting of the floats, these large barges, of making plans for how he was going to employ them, what kind of support he would need. And I remember going down several times to the Saigon shipyard as these were being welded and cut and pieced together, and getting briefings on what his operational concept was. And that was something that we had to, I say we, Dick Nicholson primarily, had to make decisions as we moved the floats into place. We did significant scouting operations in advance to see what was going to be involved in the way of the currents and the tide, to see what kind of reaction the Viet Cong would give just to the incursions of the sending the PBRs first on high-speed trips through the canal, and then later the swift boats, which had heavier firepower. And then finally the day came when we towed sea float in. That was a great experience. And I went down there sometime just shortly after we got the first moorings in to see how it was going on one of my trips. The morale was very high in the group. They were pretty uptight because they didn't know what they were going to run into, but that's good. It meant they were being alert, and they were taking plenty of precautions. We had started then protecting our woodcutters, and by day we would have the troops out cutting the brush back, as I mentioned, to get clear fire zones for you, enhanced protection, trying to have the SEALs do more incursions in areas around where there were possible routes of ingress by Viet Cong, and finding evidence of where swimmers may or may not have been entering the water. But it was, I think, a brilliant operation that, as long as we were supporting it in the way we had originally conceived that we would continue to support, it worked, because the natives started coming back in, trade was taking place around there, they were setting up their little hutches around the cleared areas. I had the experience when I was down there and over on the muddy bank, and visiting one of those little hooch areas, and here we had a Navy signalman that I had served with in a ship in Korea. And he was a signalman striker on board the Frankie Evans when we cranked her up out of mothballs to go to Korea. And here he was, now a first-class signalman and on the beach. Turned out that he was a boy from Arkansas that had volunteered for the Pigs and Chickens program, and he was bringing in breeding stock for them and living overnight in the muddy conditions and terribly infested areas, lots of mosquitoes, and the main thing, the danger of night raids by the Viet Cong, who would frequently lob mortars into the area. And you ask him, why are you doing it? Somebody's got to do it, Cap. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So the program went ahead, but later I understand that it was not sufficiently defended, it was not sufficiently supplied and resupplied promptly, and they didn't have the air cover for the really critical situations. But I can't tell you exactly how it finally expired. I think somebody figured out it took too much effort.
Mm-hmm. This is such an unconventional thing, I suppose. It's how often has the Navy been involved in establishing a base where no one would have thought of putting one in the middle of a river?
I think we can find maybe some Civil War corollaries to that somewhere around Vicksburg, or even perhaps up the James River. And there's just some recollections I have that they were setting up the bases afloat like that using some of the armor. By that time, the armored boats, as they call them, they were really tin clads virtually. Mm-hmm. And if not that, they were setting them up on the bank and then leapfrogging the way we were out there with, by moving up our little advanced bases, particularly on giant slingshot around Parrot's Peak.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any general perception or comment of combat operations from your point of view back in Saigon, plus what you saw from your trips out of the field in general, what your view of that experience was?
Firefight reports were, by the time I got there, designed pretty much to permit tabulation of data. In other words, there was a fixed format. You knew what column A, B, and C were supposed to have in it. It failed always to give you a true sense of the intensity of fire, although you said heavy machine gun fire from the enemy, duration of such a period of time. That's one thing, but going out and seeing where the wood and splinters were and the blood and the bodies and so forth leaves a much more lasting impression of what the intensity of the fight was. Mm-hmm. And so I had no feeling at any time that body count was being inflated, as had been a long-standing accusation. We looked at body count only as an indicator of the size of the force, perhaps, that had faced our personnel. Very much the tons of the arms that were discovered in caches, kept track of that, because that gave you a gauge of what was coming down. We never used it as an index of performance by anybody. I was trying to think the other factor, and I lost my train of thought, of these materials. Oh, the documents. How many documents were recovered, what was their quality and anticipated value and disposition, because it was very important that those get into a place that they could be processed by a qualified linguist, and their caches in the riverbanks, and they were sealed, and then the water would come up and go down. And one of the techniques we used, as you remember, is hydraulic pumps, high pressure fireman hose, in effect, on a mounted stand, trying to wash some of the bank away, and we found huge caches of arms that way sometimes. Mm-hmm. Buried in a cave right alongside the bank, and then by washing that away we would discover it. Mm-hmm. But if the sense of your question, Les, has to do with Navy and body counts, things of that nature, it wasn't used to that extent, and mm-hmm. because there was no no prizes awarded for body counts.
Right.
And, what did you uncover, and what did we learn by it, and how can it be used to stop the influx of more materials?
Personally, do you personally think that method of tracking progress, I mean, this has become almost a cliche in Vietnam, is the body count. Do you think that was a negative in terms of trying to perceive the war in those terms?
It would be a valuable tool, and I can't speak for the kind of pressure that some of the people were under who may have stretch the facts some. We all have a tendency to glorify our own participation, and I'm trying to not do that in my
certainly
description to you, because the success of what Atlas Omaha did would stand on its own. I don't have any substitute for it. You have to have some measure in this quantifiable world, and to an extent, McNamara operated on quantification and to get quality across to him. It was quantification, can it be analyzed, and the trends correlated, and things of that nature. So he pretty much asked for it by the kinds of reports that he wanted. That's the way he had been successful in assisting the Air Force in World War II. Then he thought he could run the Pentagon and the war that way. And it didn't work out that well. I don't know human nature being what it is and the pressure that was being applied. I can't add anything.
When Admiral Zumwalt's son came to Vietnam, what was your view of that?
I forecast, in fact, that he would make every effort to show no favoritism. Mm-hmm. His son would be even more, feared this probably more than anything, but young Elmo, in trying to show that he was not getting favoritism, volunteering for some of the most dangerous missions, mm-hmm. from the market time operation, volunteered to go down into the Sea Lord's operation and immediately placed himself at great risk. He was a wonderful young man, and so much like what his father must have been in his younger days. Bright, outstanding leader, loyal to his troops, to a fault, looked after them, realized his responsibilities. The Admiral's reaction, and my father at that time, the sons that were only 8 and 10 years old, so I couldn't directly, but I could almost sense his, his concern and fear, and yet he wanted his son to do what he felt like he had to. And, he didn't interfere. Took place after young Elmo had been in country, I think about 6 months, the Admiral wanted him to come up and be his personal aide. The Admiral saw precedent for that in what General Eisenhower had done and some other notables. And I was trying to think, other than General Eisenhower, who else had a son in combat. But young Elmo said, no, I'm going to do that. It would be too apparent that Dad was just looking out for him, and the argument that the Admiral lost, and he was wise enough not to insist on it. It was always, he almost dreaded reading of action reports from that area. Mm-hmm. And, he was in some very hot firefights several times that resulted in there were two or three boats together in an action that they really ran into a hot firefight, and a couple of the boats, one at least, had struck a mine, and there were crew members in the water, and Elmo dove in to recover, save the life of one or two of them. And this was one of the times he got so thoroughly doused, we were sure, because that age area had been heavily sprayed with Agent Orange. Could have well been because of breathing and ingesting some of the river water. But he was a fearless kid, but just my father, my son, so you know that story well, and it's very well written, I think. Mm-hmm. Very true. The Admiral showed no favorites, and he did not insist on any special reports whatsoever, because he was reading the message traffic himself. Incident that he really distanced himself from. There was a case of, and it was before before Young Elmo came down in the Delta, they had a new Vietnamese gunner on board for training. And when you come back from a patrol, there was a mandatory order that rounds be removed from all chambers for the tied up in the nest. For some reason, one person on these boats made the mistake of not having cleared a round out of that gun. It resulted in, I forget the details of how the Vietnamese was involved and whether even he was. That seemed to be the cloudy area, as I recollect. But anyhow, someone squeezed that trigger and a crewman was killed by that shot, of course. And the admiral, since I got the report, I told him, it's important that you distance yourself from this, and we have a separate outside investigation, which he immediately agreed to. And it was learned, of course, but he recognized that the worst thing he could do would be in the form of getting a directed, favorable report. Mm-hmm. So he immediately said, we got an investigation separately, mm-hmm. and it went correct. Beyond him and without his endorsement, as I recall.
Well, along those lines, I think this raises an interesting question as to how much, maybe a better way to phrase this would be, your relationship with him.
With Young Elmo or the Admiral?
With the Admiral. How much did he confide in you, his concerns about anything? Or his son, for example?
I think we had a very, very good relationship. Yes, he confided his concern and his reasoning, and I was sometimes maybe trying to be overprotective, and maybe that's not a good description. I wanted to try and give him the benefit of my views on things, knowing that he was perfectly well qualified, but occasionally there were blind spots for any of us, mm-hmm. and I felt I would be negligent if I didn't point out what I thought was either a higher risk than had been discussed or things of that nature. And I felt comfortable doing it because he realized that I was totally supporting him. In doing so, I was just trying to be sure that we had looked at all facets. This was particularly true when we started moving the small bases on the Scotch up, where the water was getting narrower and shallower, and so our little patrol bases were getting smaller and smaller, but we had to do it to establish the outposts and the barriers. And I consistently asked additional questions at a briefing one day on the final approval for this plan. And afterwards, he asked me to remain behind after the briefing. He said, Emmett, I realize and I appreciate the support you gave me on the plan, but I realized what you were doing was trying to be sure that we had covered all facets of it, and I appreciate it, and I want you not to hesitate to do it in the future. So my point there is he welcomed somebody that was giving thoughtful consideration to a plan that everybody was quick to say, yeah, this is a great idea. Now, that's unfair to the rest of the staff to say everybody did, because we had some good operational people. Dave Emerson, who later became Vice Admiral. Dave Emerson was operations officer and superb, and very little had gotten by him, but still, if I saw something, a relationship with the Admiral and with the rest of his heads of departments, I felt comfortable in bringing up things that I thought the Admiral should get confirmation from the staff of, yes, this has been considered and what our evaluation is. At no time was there any competition that I felt in trying to get his attention or do a handstand. Mm-hmm. And he would discuss, I would say, minor family items. The family was so close and so supportive of each other, and his relationship with Musa is just a thing of beauty. And so it there were no problems like that that were even necessary to discuss. But I, my room was right beside his up here in the building, and where the flag quarters. And you know, you live beside a person like that for a year, and then come back with them on a round the world trip, when our trip back to the U.S. and then that I went through as head of the Decision Coordination Center, you do become close to a person like that. And I think he was very frank with me on some of these things that he confided in, evaluations of people, and making his own judgments, but he would periodically ask me for what my opinion was, and I didn't like that.
Mm-hmm. So this was more than just a formal commander subordinate.
And I think that's to his, it's a testimony to his nature, and you will see how quickly you feel a part of the family when when you're working for him, or you're on his team, and something like that. And that's why I continue to this day to do anything possible to help him.
I guess that can't help but develop and those he works with a sense of belonging that will make them want, out of their own desire, to you know, to return to him something of.
And it's even more so. The bonding is more important in a combat situation, such as that. I'd say a war-fighting situation. We were not under fire the way the guys were every night, although we could always hear the guns around us and the mortars going off at night, across the river particularly. But
see the flares?
Yeah.
Everything I know from this, I get from reading, obviously, so I try and read as much as possible. Something you mentioned earlier about seeing the reports and sending them along to him, did you have the job also of vetting that this mass of incoming message traffic and information, was it part of your job to evaluate that and to decide what was important enough to take up his time with?
No, I learned very early, as I mentioned, my predecessor was killing himself trying to do that, and the problem was the Admiral's such a speed reader himself and has such a quick eye for what was important and what wasn't by his experience out there, that what I was trying to do in my message reading was A, to backstop him, and B, to stay current and do my damnedest to keep up with him. And that was a very significant part of it. Because he was able to read his own traffic, keep what he wanted, mark up certain ones for action that he had had me at breakfast. But I did not try to filter his traffic at all. Now, I got into that position in the Pentagon when it became CNO and I was running the Decision Coordinating Center. The role in that, to just briefly, and we can cover it more later if you want to, but was to try and get the briefings that people wanted to give him for decision. I would have him do a pre-brief rehearsal in the area that I established up there, a top secret sensitive area, that they could brief, and I tried to get them down concise as possible, then demand a one-page brief sheet to accompany their briefing script, which I would then review and give him my comments on it. That's the closest that you could say I came to screening his traffic. Mm-hmm. And the briefings that I turned back and required them to redo until they got it down, were not because of the conclusions or recommendations they had, but so that it would be, you know, the stuff that I knew he was aware of was not taking up time with the briefing, but that would get him right to the meat of it. Mm-hmm. And then by him having pre-read it like this, he could come in with his ideas formed. He may even have a decision, but he was always open-minded. He came in wanting to hear the opposing views because he knew he was going to get them up the tape somewhere. And so he wanted either to be able to defend himself from his old debating techniques by knowing what the other person's views were, or simply realizing that these people had put a lot of time and effort in on it, and he felt he owed them a chance to say their piece. So, and they were in the Pentagon, and in the Jeffrey Sands CNA paper, there was criticism about the kitchen staff meeting and formulating the decisions in advance. I think this was greatly overblown for the self-aggrandizement of some people who, you know, 10,000 ants on the log going down, that every one of them thought that they were driving. And, that's the old classic about the Pentagon. But he would read things, and with an open mind, he might make a quick decision, but I've seen him change his mind after people had had a chance to say their piece. So he was open-minded. But back to the question of the traffic, that was a trap that the previous chief of staff fell into of trying to stay ahead of him, and you couldn't do it in that particular area with the amount of traffic and his capability, and it really was an impediment to him. And later in our discussions of how we were going to operate, he said it really was more of a delay to read somebody else's notes when he was perfectly capable of reading the message, and then if he had a question, he had asked, hand it to me. If I saw something that I wanted to be very sure that he caught in the traffic, I would have that ready to bring up at breakfast.
Right. Well, that, the idea of a briefing, that, plus what you said earlier about discussion with a correspondent, brings to mind a question about, did you ever have much contact with the press in Vietnam? Or you get the idea that this is a media war, almost.
There was one time I remember very vividly, because that was one time we blew it. We had a public affairs officer who was a good one, that was out of Chin Pho. And the admiral was to give a briefing, and I really can't remember exactly what it was on, but it had to do with operations. And because there was such an interest in it and the number of media that we met in the living room at the flag quarters, because it gave us a chance to bring the media in and keep them out of the classified briefing room of headquarters, and we could, you know, serve them drinks and so forth before they all got there. And the admiral thought that it was to be an off-the-record briefing, and that was the understanding I had. The public affairs officer, though, in pre-briefing the press, had not declared it as an off-the-record briefing. I sensed this after the thing broke up, and in asking some questions, found out that, you know, they've scattered to the winds, and they think this is on the record, and advised him the first thing to do is call St. Pat Fleet, which he had already indicated he was going to do. I remember the details because it really hit the fan, but by immediately notifying General Abrams and St. Pat Fleet and St. Pat, at that time it was Admiral McCain, it took the sting out of it, and okay, hunker down in your bunker and take it. We did something dumb, and we learned a lesson. And thereafter, when we had any kind of a session like that, we double-checked to be sure what the ground rules of the briefing were, and it was a good lesson for him in preparation for becoming CNO to always know and declare yourself what the ground rules are for the briefing. My other contact had to do with periodically having the individual into my office when he had was going out or coming back from a special event type of, you know, you set him up to have something for an in-depth trip. And discussing with him the business of negativism, and just hoping all we ask for you is to please report the full story. Don't just hammer on the negatives. We're getting all of that. Look and see what the Viet Cong have done. Look and see what the North Vietnamese have done. Don't always look at the Marine with the cigarette lighter burning the thatch hut. Look and see it. at the 100 huts that have been destroyed by the Vietcong when they moved in, it caused us to go into that area.
Did you sort of ever have almost a combative relationship with them? Did they come into your office with an attitude and you would have to deal with that?
They were unique individuals. They had a personality that you realized they wouldn't be there if they didn't have that certain, it's not macho, but I guess it's the chutzpah of the journalists maybe. And their sense is they have to get under your skin some if they're going to get the story.
Right.
And there were only two or three like that, but in fairness, our public affairs officer dealt with them mostly. And then if it was anything of significance, the admiral dealt with them. My role was really not to get into the public affairs business, other than as it may occur to clear a given trip by one of so many days, not as much an administrative function, but as a, yes, somebody knows from headquarters what this in-depth trip is and is about, so that we could let the admiral know in case he had to tell General Abrams.
So actually dealing with the press outside of administration was really outside your purview then?
Yeah.
Let me ask you, when the admiral discovered that he was probably going to become CNO, how did his departure from Vietnam coincide with your departure from Vietnam, and what was your perception of how that developed and those events at that time?
That was very interesting. I had been informed. We found out about it in April. He had, the previous month, been called for a trip back to Washington, which was not altogether unusual in that he would go back periodically for briefings. And just as an aside, he would sense periodically when one of the staff, the senior staff people, had been out there a while, right on edge, there may be a family problem or something of that nature, or he just felt that they had been working too damn hard. And he would designate them as the top secret briefer, go back to Washington to give the monthly update to the in the flag theater in the Navy area. And he would see that they took 3 or 4 days leave when they were back there, and would always route the orders, have the orders. Standing rule was that those orders would carry them back through wherever their family might be. Mm-hmm. And then they can give a Navy League speech or something like that while they're there to justify it. But it was a compassionate thing, really, that fulfilled a need to get a briefing back there. But he went back a month before he was really called in for the final, to be informed that he had been selected. And ostensibly to give a briefing to Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Navy, and Kissinger, and ostensibly the President, although I don't think the President got in on it at that time. But in retrospect then, we realized that he was being looked at that time in the final selection process. But it was entirely logical for him to go back, and this is like maybe February. Well, then in April, he got called back, and that's when he found out. He was directed to go back without telling anyone of his departure, that he was going to Washington. And he told it was Mr. Chafee, I think, that called him. And he said, I can't do that. I have an immediate military superior in a combat area, and I have to inform General Abrams of that and sink back the fleet. And Mr. Chafee agreed to that, provided they would pass the word on. Well, then it was kind of the tip-off when it was that he was supposed to come in civilian clothes also, which he did. That, you know, we thought there was a possibility, but you look at the list and there were 39 people senior to him, and we had our business, and of course as chief of staff, I wasn't even supposed to tell the deputy that he was out of town. It's just, he's not in communications at this time. The deputy was the first Sea Lord, and really came in only about once a week into Saigon State in the Delta area. And was with it, and that he was being nominated, and which he did, and we were very thrilled for him. And at the time, he went, just before he went back to Washington in February, I had received word, he probably received word first and told me that I had or the guided missile cruiser Columbus, that major command that I would have gone to had I not been shanghaied to Vietnam, which I'm sure he had much to do with those orders. He said, however, Emmett, I'll bet you a bottle of champagne and $10 now that you will never get to Columbus. And I said, I beg your pardon, sir? And he said, well, I had orders to the USS Columbus when I was a crew and a half at the time, and Mr. Nitzer bet me that I would never get there, and I didn't because I got selected for Rear Admiral. And he said, I'll bet the same thing happens to you. Well, then about 2 or 4 weeks later, we found out that the board was being convened, and it was a board, it was the classic Admiral Tom Moore selection board of his protege, so to speak. And the Admiral told me that I really want to apologize to you because you're so closely identified with me now that you don't stand a chance with this board, and I really regret it.
Of making a Rear Admiral?
Of being selected for Rear Admiral. And I said, I'm just looking forward to my champagne because I didn't expect it. It was way early for me. It'd be the first look that I would have gotten as a potential flag selectee, and which is too damn swamped with my job to be worrying about what might be in the future. Just wanted to, you know, get the job done and get through there. Well, making the story shorter, we found out about his selection, and he said, I would like to delay your reporting to the Columbus until after we get back to Washington so that you can be the my executive assistant for the trip around the world, going back to meet all of the four stars of all of our services, as well as foreign navies, and, you know, touching bases with the people that he should make courtesy calls on in advance, as well as the Navy types to get briefed. Mm-hmm.
So when, excuse me for a moment, if he is replaced as COMNAV-4V and you were his chief of staff, does that automatically mean that the new COMNAV-4V will have his own chief of staff, so you would not remain in that position?
He would have his option on that, but mm-hmm. The general rule, this is not like a personal aide, although you're the aide and chief of staff, and where the lazy loops in that job when it's appropriate. Normally, a rational individual would say, gee, I need the overlap of, like the executive officer should overlap the CO, and they're not both of them change at one time, so it is. To my knowledge, the individual that we selected to relieve me actually early so I could start planning that trip around the world, and I was charged with making the arrangements through the rest of the staff and determining the itinerary, which basically the Admiral decided what he wanted to do, and it was my job to get it implemented and then work up the various point papers, questions, and advance contact with the places as to what we were interested in. Part of the job, I told him I just can't do this and still be a good chief of staff for the war that we're fighting. Why don't we bring up the individual that we had selected, Captain McDaniels, on the staff because he'd been in country six months. He was senior to me even, but a very good staff individual, and we found that he was very reliable. And the Admiral readily agreed, bring him on up in and let him fill the chair. If he needs to ask any questions, they put me in almost a little closet for doing the work that I was to prepare for the trip. So I was to make the trip around the world with him, which I did, except when we got to Shanghai, I got word right a little bit. The preparations for the staff we brought in, an old friend of his who you should talk to, and that's Admiral Bill Thompson, who was a Chin Fo trained individual. They had been friends, formed when the Admiral was with SecNav, and his roommate was Dave Bag. I know that's wrong. They had been longstanding friends. The Admiral judged his, valued his judgment very much, and so Bill Thompson was brought out to Saigon about a month before we left, and I told the Admiral we needed somebody in that was accustomed to making these arrangements, particularly with the foreign governments, and there's a regular procedure and a shop set up back in OPNAV for that, and at that time it was OP 61, the Political Military Affairs Division, which Admiral Crow had been in. And I recommended, nominated an individual that I had been in the National War College with, Tom Bigley, who was a captain at that time, doing a very good job. Yeah, we got that mini staff assembled, and for making the trip, we got to Shanghai. Bill Thompson and I had been out for dinner, and I got back. We were at the old Raffles Hotel in Shanghai, and I had a note in my box to call Muggs, and she gave me the good news that I'd been selected for Rear Admiral at that time.
Wow.
So I lost my champagne and $10 and owed him champagne.
Never saw the Columbus then.
Never saw the Columbus. Muggs had rented. She had leased a house in Norfolk. She had already gotten our house leased. We were set up for the boys in school down there. Never been better organized for a move. And I had had pictures of the ship, and I'd been in correspondence with the skipper, and never got to the Columbus.
Oh, you're disappointed?
You know, nobody's going to give you sympathy for missing a cruiser when you're getting 2 stars, and
right.
That's the kind of sympathy you get. You would have liked to have had it, sure, but would you pass up the selection early? No.
No. And you did you go from directly from that to the flotilla?
No. I did the year as head of setting up this